Astonishing Legends Network.
The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
I'm not saying it's not a good idea, madam. I'm just suggesting that you may want to reconsider your method.
It's all the rage right now, darling. Everyone is posing next to famous artworks that they are lookalikes with.
Yes, they're posing next to the Mona Lisa. They haven't dug up Da Vinci, put a zombie hex on him, and made him paint them as the Mona Lisa.
Only because they don't have the resources, darling. Now, has my see-through gown and severed head arrived?
Yes, it's all here. I am amazed at what you can get on Amazon these days.
Greetings, everyone. How good of you to visit. How lovely you all look. What? Why are so many of you wearing scarves and cowls cinched up around your neck? Oh. Excuse me. Right. I forgot that tonight's topic makes some human people extra nervous and, squirmy. Excuse me. I promise you, you're barely in any danger at all. If you do as you're told. I'm kidding. Please take your seats. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. I am your hard-headed host, Miranda Merrick. My. Please try to relax. It seems whenever we broach the subject of beheadings or vampires or throat-ripping beasties, well, there's a palpable nervousness that fills the reading room. I swear some of you must be the descendants of those who have lost their heads. Or you are the reincarnated, actual choppies. If you are, I definitely want to chat with you after the reading, so keep that in mind. You can at least be comforted by the fact that we haven't wheeled in our antique guillotine like we did the last time. Only because it's at Beelzebub's Blade Works this week. For, polishing. Let me tell you what's on the hospitality tray, while you try to settle in and relax. In honor of our delicious topic of beheadings in art, Natasha has happily lopped off all of the heads of all of the things she has cookie-cutter molds of. This was really very thoughtful of her. On one plate are the bodies of, well, let's see, what looks to be like a ringmaster from a circus, several Renaissance-looking people. I know that one. It's a zookeeper. And that seated one is a snake charmer, for sure. That chubby fellow looks like Santa Claus, but I'm pretty sure it's not him. Anyway, all of the heads, which I suppose you could mix and match if you like, are on the other plate. Such a team player she is, our Natasha. And I can tell you, it's best to be on her team. That's for sure. I am compelled to tell you, my lovely guest, that we often get requests for topics. Most of these come by mail and are delivered by our Lydia, of course. However, and I'm only sharing this with you, mind you, so don't repeat it. The request for beheadings in art was made by the ghost of a beheaded person who shall remain nameless. I just saw their head floating in my crystal ball, and I was delighted. Until they began moaning on about being marginalized in the afterlife, and a forgotten rarity in the present, and saying that it's the only claim to fame that some of them have, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you wouldn't think a ghosty severed head would have all that much to say, but you'd be wrong about that. In any case, I could only get them to agree to just pass by and let some other spirits come through by promising to elaborate on how a few incredible scenes of beheadings are forever memorialized in famous works of art, and by dutifully describing them in bloody detail. And boy, do I have some doozies for you. Let us begin. If, out of sheer curiosity, you were to simply search the three words in the title of this reading, Beheadings in Art, and I so recommend that you do, you might guess confidently in advance that what you would find would be depictions of some of the most famous beheadings in history. Portrayals of the two wives Henry VIII had done away with in this manner. Or the beheading of King Louis XVI or his wife Marie Antoinette. Or any number of other historic people who had their heads ceremoniously separated from their bodies. But I can promise you, my dear visitor, that these are not the decapitations commemorated on canvas that you would see first. In fact, the most famous painting of a beheading features people who likely didn't exist at all. Now, don't be sad. There are those who contest that these people might well have existed, although they are in the minority. This is the painting of Judith beheading Holofernes. And I have to admit, real or not, but I so hope it is, I love this story and the many renditions of it that have been put down in paint, no matter how gory or not they are. The story of Judith and the possible reasons it is included in one holy book and not in another is kind of hazy, gossipy, or even judgmental, it seems. Briefly, the Book of Judith is considered to be a viable holy text or story, and her book is included in the Old Testament. Judith's story is excluded from the Hebrew Bible and the Protestant version of the Bible. It is said because it is not believed to be what is called canon or true doctrine. However, scholars speculate that a number of alternative reasons for Judith's exclusion range from her story being Greek in origin, supportive of factions others were opposed to, and for its portrayal of a strong, bold, and seductive female character. Luckily, these qualities are precisely what made this one daring beheading extremely seductive to artists. The story of unbridled female rage, Judith slaying Holofernes, is the most popularly painted beheading by miles ahead of any other. Countless artists simply could not resist her. First, a bit of context. The story goes that an Assyrian king sent his best general, Holofernes, to attack the Jewish city of Bethulia in a massive, murderous battle. And Judith, a widow, possibly of one of the men killed, was known to be young, beautiful, and more than just a little infuriated by the attack on her city and people. It was said that she hatched a plan to avenge them both by first seducing the prodigious general, entertaining him while he drank himself silly, and then by removing his head. And Caravaggio's version is many people's first choice rendering for this true or not true happening. I cannot tell you that it's not one of my absolute favorites. This graphic, shocking, and gripping painting by Caravaggio is one that you simply cannot look away from. It's as vivid in color as it is violent in action. What makes it most compelling is that there are only three characters in the scene. But your view of what's happening, being so close to your eyes, makes it seem as though you are the fourth. It's as if you have just parted the heavy curtains of the general's tent and found yourself a close-up witness to the very moment that his head and body part company. Here, sprawled before you on his risen bed, is the waking in a panic general, Holofernes. A brawny figure, twisting in horror and struggling to see just who it is that's cutting off his head. At the head of his bed stands the petite and pretty Judith. It's already half done. She's chosen her moment, picked up his saber, and grabbed a great handful of his curly dark hair to hold him down. And she's ran the blade past the midway point of his thick, manly neck. As the muscle of her forearm flexes to keep his weighty head in place, his eyes lurch back and upward, staring straight at her, as several speedy jets of his bright blood shoot forth from the large arteries she's slicing through. The artist has made sure that the color of his blood is a perfect match for the highlights in the rich red curtain that serves as the painting's intimate backdrop. Young, pretty Judith, although she seems a bit annoyed, you can see her brow is gathered. Perhaps she's irked that Holofernes wasn't drunk enough to think he was dreaming this. Judith is dressed in fairly smart, finer peasant woman clothing and wearing eye-catching earrings with black bows and white teardrop pearls. The color of her neat red hair also echoes the streams of spurting red blood. The third character is Judith's elderly maid and helpful accomplice. In the story, she accompanies her mistress to watch over her and serve her as she gains entrance to the general's encampment. She prepares all of Judith's food for the 3 days that she's there to entertain Holofernes. And in this single moment, she has a job that she's more than willing to perform. With anger, resentment, and dire determination writ large into the furrows of her aged face, the mighty little maid holds the sturdy cloth bag that the general's detached head is to fall into. This was said to be done so that, according to plan, Judith and her maid would simply and quietly exit the encampment with all of their clothing and traveling goods early in the morning, along with the purloined head of Holofernes tucked away with them. No one would ever suspect that the pretty woman and her old maid were ruthless assassins, and whosever job it was to wake the general from his wild night of intoxication and, let's say, merriment, would find their commander without his head. This dangerous and bold act by Judith was said to have saved her city from complete obliteration. The artist Caravaggio, at one time or another, was a student, a painter, a swordsman, an instigator, a knight, an accidental murderer and fugitive. His youth was marked by his family having to move several times to outrun outbreaks of the plague. But he showed enough early talent to have signed on as a student painter at the young age of 12, under a minor master in Milan. He was initially meant to be a fresco painter, but he was much more interested in becoming proficient at fencing, which served him well in his adult life, as he was famous for picking fights and stirring up trouble in public places, resulting in his being jailed and sued in the courts. As his skills as a painter sharpened, so did his attitude about what he painted. While others were embracing more bucolic or sophisticated scenes of royalty, Caravaggio chose to portray the poverty of the life of Jesus, the violence of confrontation, and a level of biting realism that most had never seen on canvas before. It is said that he painted drama because he lived dramatically. Caravaggio's striking rendition of Judith beheading Holofernes debuted to mixed reviews from the public when it was first shown, with some celebrating the stark realism of the painting, while others found its grotesque violence to be too much to take. I happen to love it for both of these reasons, and I hope you will view it. In these modern times, two unusual things have happened in relation to this expressive painting. A pasta company thought it was a good idea to use Judith's exact face from the painting on their Italian red sauce, which makes it seem as though she's bottled up for sale the blood of Holofernes. And it has also been mentioned by many an observer of how Judith, in this jolting painting, bears a resemblance to actress Scarlett Johansson. Now, my lovelies, let us move from shocking to disturbing, shall we? Of course. First, a quick synopsis of Medusa. The beautiful snake-haired goddess. Okay, so she wasn't a goddess. She was a gorgon, one of three snake-haired monsters. But initially, she was a beautiful princess who was, let's say, attacked with unwanted affection by Neptune. And for this, she was somehow the one who was punished by being turned into a deadly snake-haired gorgon. Deadly because the very moment any human made eye contact with her or saw her face, they would instantly turn to stone forever. In order to defeat her, Perseus crept up upon her while she slept. By walking backward and only seeing her reflection in the shine of his mirrored shield, he cut off her head with a magic sword. I think we can all agree that there aren't nearly enough magic swords these days, or snake-haired women, right? Our second featured painting this evening, and I hope you've long since finished your cookies before viewing it so you don't chuck them, is The Head of Medusa by Peter Paul Rubens from roughly the early 17th century. This painting, although it is straight out of Greek mythology, packs a visual punch not everyone is ready for. It certainly made a splash during its time and continues to do so today. The Head of Medusa was considered to be so jarring that when it was eventually displayed to the public, 200 years after it was painted, it had to remain behind a curtain and explained to those about to view it in order to give them time to prepare themselves. There is no other context in this painting. There is no clear background. There is no sword or any hint of the man who swung it. There is only the profusely bleeding severed head of Medusa and her now maniacal snakes who seem prompted into wild and fantastical actions from the astonishment of their owner's murder. Her head, that has just a moment ago splatted upon the ground, lies ironically on a stony slab. It is surrounded by countless twirling and writhing snakes in shades of pale white, green, pewter gray, and reddish or russet tones. Their scales gleam as they move. Some are escaping, some are fighting, and some are forming as baby serpents in the rivulets of blood flowing from the bedraggled neck of her amputated head. One defiantly bites her temple, turning on her as if angry that it will soon die too. Other creeping things, insects, spiders and scorpions are scurrying toward her, and a very odd snake with a head at each end, wiggles around the slain Medusa, who's wearing a beyond horrified expression. She is ashen in color, with her eyes glaring, and clearly alive at this moment, and well aware that she's just been killed. There is simply no other expression in art like this expression of hers. My word, you must see it. Poor babe. This masterpiece, created by Peter Paul Rubens, was quite the puzzle for quite some time, hundreds of years. The painting was so shocking for its Baroque time period. It seemed no one wanted to take credit for painting it, as it arrived for display unsigned in 1818. It was donated by a private owner, and no one knew how long he had owned it or who really owned it before him. For years, art experts applied their own knowledge to hazard guesses at just who was their best guess or prime suspect for being responsible for the creation of this monster piece. It wasn't until 1899 that more learned art scholars mentioned the name Peter Paul Rubens as the most likely culprit. Then, in the progressing 20th century, as the work was studied closer, analyzed in detail, and even restoration was done on the painting, that it was confirmed that only Rubens' style, palette, and unique brushstrokes could be found in the swirls of this dark painting. Except for the snakes. Oddly enough, it is firmly believed that his friend and collaborator, Franz Schneider, literally gave him a hand and helped with the painting of the many contorting snakes. Peter Paul Rubens was born in 1577, served as a page to a princess as a young boy, quickly decided to become an artist, and was met with success at every turn. He was known not only as a painter, but also a diplomat and a scholar and an instructor. And he painted everything from saintly altarpieces to dignified portraits and rolling landscapes, and apparently one much decapitated, snake-haired she-monster. Our third featured painting, that is my next choice, may come as a bit of a surprise to some of you. And I promise I'm not cheating or being lazy somehow. If anything, I have a most delectably sinister suggestion of a way for you to have the most sly fun with this next painting. It's also a fabulous example of how the very same subject can be interpreted vastly differently from one artist to the next when they paint the exact same thing. Holy Hecate! I love this painting so much. My lovelies, I give you Judith and the Head of Holofernes, painted by Gustav Klimt in 1901. Everything about Klimt's version of Judith and Holofernes is unconventional. Its dimensions are a strange elongated rectangle, being 33 inches tall by only 17 inches wide. It has its own artist-created frame, which bears the title at its top. It is overwhelmingly lush and inviting, and positively gleams, literally because of the artist's lavish use of shimmering gold leaf layers amongst his fine brushstrokes. And quite frankly, biblical heroine is not the first phrase that jumps to mind upon seeing it. It is a symphony in Art Nouveau style, featuring a triumphant Judith with her classic and beautiful head held high and tilted slightly back. With a serene, some say daringly satisfied look on her vixen-like face, her wide gold and studded choker fitted tightly about her neck only intensifies her bold presence. To say that this painting stunned the public when it debuted in Vienna is an understatement. Klimt's version of the Bible-bound woman who risked her life to avenge her city was absolutely scandalous. And to be honest, I get it. But I still love it. Klimt's Judith is a true femme fatale. She is a glamorous seductress, standing proudly and smugly, with one of her delicate breasts exposed and the other barely concealed by her baby blue see-through chiffon and gold negligee. This Judith is one strikingly beautiful murderess. Judith's glowing gown and the idyllic background of the painting both feature Assyrian motifs with swirling pinwheels and tiny stars. And the enchanting gilt forest behind her seems proud to be presenting her. The painting ends abruptly below her belly button with another band of bejeweled sparkling gold. Judith here is so glaringly bewitching that you only notice that she's holding the head of Holofernes on her hip after several minutes of looking at the painting. It's hard to believe that she's beheaded him, as her fingers seem to be almost playfully rustling his hair. Holofernes seems incidental in the painting. And even then, he is such a minor character here that Klimt chose to show only half of his sleepy-looking head. Judith is the star of this provocative painting. I do hope you get to see it and get a copy of it and hang it in your house. And then send me stories of the astounding reactions she stirs up with your visitors. Klimt. Gustav Klimt was born the second of seven children in Austria in 1862 and had a poor childhood, but showed great artistic ability early on. He trained at the Vienna School of Arts. His father, by trade, was a gold engraver, which is believed to have cemented his fondness for using gold leaf appliqué in his radiant paintings. He enjoyed much success as an artist in his own lifetime, was married to only one woman, but couldn't have cared less for the sanctity of marriage, as he had many affairs and was believed to have fathered at least 14 children. Which is interesting, because so many photos of him show him looking untidy, with the tousled, thinning hair, and wearing a long, rumpled painting shift or gown with splatters all over it. You've just come from the restroom and seen a man who looked just like that in the cordoned off area. I wonder if a prowler or a miscreant from the village has somehow gotten in. Mr. Darling, you and a few goons will hunt him down, won't you?
Certainly, madam.
See what we're up against here, my lovelies. Please do be careful as you cross Phantom Forest in the mysterious dark of night, because I would be just so miffed if anything savagely destroyed you. Wouldn't I, Mr. Darling?
Certainly, madam. Mm-hmm.
See? Good night.
How is Klimt doing, darling? Is he ready to paint?
He's changing out of his burial suit into his painting gown now, madam. He's very chatty.
Perfect. My plan to have him exhumed to paint is working.
You do know he has a plan too, right?
What plan?
He's mumbled several times now about a 15th child with you. He keeps saying tit for tat.
That sounds more like tit for brat. I'm out. How about you bite him and I'll bury him?
Done.
Now, I'm so very pleased to tell you, spooky lovelies, that over our brief downtime between seasons, there's a never-before event being held in our Patreon. Over the next few weeks, I will be giving away books from my own private collection as prizes to win by our paid patrons from anywhere at any level. The books being given away range from the popular to the obscure. Each book will arrive with an official Midnight Library bookplate and bookmark, and it will be signed from me to you. I love the idea of my books finding new homes with folks like you, who will love them as I have, and not be bothered at all when the ghostly voices that inhabit them speak to you from your bookshelves. When you join our Patreon at the $5 level or above, you will have access to the newly published long story of Stephen Strangeways and all of our early and ad-free readings a week earlier than the public. Even more perks are available at the higher tiers. And it's true, I'll be happy to greet you there. Please visit our overflowing with strange goodies Patreon at patreon.com/midnightlibrary. The Midnight Library would like to thank everyone at Astonishing Legends. Our excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. And our fabulously weird merch can be found at Redbubble facebook.com/people/midnight library. Thank you, spooky lovelies.